720 WGN. John Hanson in for Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this hot Saturday, September 23rd. And Bob Kessler, I say if we're going to break the record, let's just go for it. Let's go all the way up to 95, 96, something
let's,
like
let's
that.
Let's really
destroy it. Yeah, okay. we want this year to be remembered forever, that 2017, the heat wave of late September. 312-917-200. I'd love to hear, this is always a question when it gets this hot of this year. People say, oh, it's such a nice day outside. And I wonder, is anyone actually, I mean, there's a lot of people out here on Michigan Avenue walking the streets I see. They seem pretty comfortable. But are you enjoying this day inside or outside? Are you driving somewhere inside or outside? Let me know via text 312-981-7200. We got a lot to get to here on the Wintrust Business Lunch today. The debate over GMOs in agriculture is certainly nothing new, and neither is the debate about using pesticides on our farms. But there is a new wrinkle to that discussion today, and we're going to chat about that. Danny Hakim is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He joins us now to chat about that. Danny, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, so I want to set this up a little bit for people, Danny. So agriculture giant Monsanto has this strong weed killer. I think it's – am I saying it right? Dicamba? Is that how they say that?
Dicamba.
Dicamba. So it's been around for a few years, and it's so strong that they've had to now develop a seed that is modified to be resistant to that weed killer. Now, that in and of itself is an interesting discussion, but what's causing a big issue is dicamba is making its way onto farms that don't have those seeds in their fields, which causes damage to the crop. Danny, I am not a farmer, and sometimes these things go over my head. Did I set that up okay?
You were close. You know, I think For about 20 years, we've had genetically modified seeds on farms, and mostly they use a weed killer called Roundup, which is the most popular weed killer in the world. The problem that has developed over the years is that weeds, you know, a lot of weeds are resistant, becoming resistant to Roundup. So what they've done is they've gone back to the lab, and they've now created soybean and cotton seeds that are also resistant to dicamba, another weed killer. So the idea is you can spray your crops. I mean, dicamba has been used for years, mm-hmm. but you always use it before your crops come out of the ground.
I see.
Now you can use it after your crops come out of the ground. You can spray your crops with dicamba. It won't kill the soybean or the cotton, but it will kill the weed. That's the idea.
And the issue the dicamba, the spraying of it after the plant is up in the air or you start to see the crop come up, it is spreading to other fields. And obviously that's farmers right. that don't have this seed that is resistant to it are seeing a really adverse effect on their crop.
That's right. Yeah, because if you don't buy the soybean seed that's resistant to dicamba, you just buy a regular soybean seed and this, you know, dicamba spreads to your field, then you've got a real problem. Then your crop gets damaged because dicamba is designed to, you know, it's harmful to plant life. So, if your crop is not resistant to it, it will probably get harmed.
So what are farmers trying to do now?
Well, a lot of farmers who have had this happen are suing Monsanto. And Monsanto is not the only company involved. BASF is another one. There's a lot of lawsuits now. And then you're also seeing Arkansas has barred it, and they're considering banning it after a certain point in the season next year. So that's going to be a big regulatory fight.
Monsanto says that they're not responsible for the spread of dicamba beyond the farms that are using the weed killer. So who do they say is responsible for this overreach of this weed killer?
Well, they say it's a problem of training. It's an issue of farmers sort of using the right equipment and also using the right kind of dicamba. They have a special formulation of it that's supposed to be more stable. So they say that's the problem. Other weed scientists and farmers say those aren't the only problems. The part of the problem is when you use this weed killer, even though it's been used for years, when you use it later in the season, when it gets hotter and more humid, it can turn into a gas and drift. And that means training isn't going to fix that. So that's where the real debate is, what's causing the drift.
Do we know how much harm this has on the crop, or is this something we're going to have to wait until the harvest is over to really ascertain what's happened?
I think you really have to wait to the harvest. One estimate I've seen is that, about 3 million acres have been affected. But I think we're going to have to wait to the harvest to see, what kind of dollar figures attached to this.
Okay, so when we have these sort of breakdowns in whether it's the training, the application, or maybe the product itself is faulty, we rely on our government regulatory agencies to help us out. In this case, perhaps I imagine the EPA would have some role in this. I'm sure some other regulatory bodies. But now that we have such a pro-business administration advising the EPA to do certain things, does that add a wrinkle to what's going on?
Well, a little bit. However, in this case, the EPA is actually taking a look at this also. So even though the EPA, certainly hasn't been, aggressive in general, over the last few months, on this issue, they are taking a look at it. So, even the EPA is weighing what to do.
Is this re-energizing the discussion about GMOs and the weed killers? I mean, for me, the fact that the weeds are becoming resistant to Roundup and we have to continue to develop stronger and stronger killers of these weeds to the point now that we have to develop seeds to become resistant of this. I mean, maybe this is a debate as old as time, but to me, does anyone talk about that seems crazy in and of itself?
Well, yeah, I think that's where the debate is. And it's actually not as old as time. It's only 20 years that we've been doing this, where we've had genetically modified crops. So, it's a relatively new debate we're having. But, there are many weed scientists, outside the agrochemical companies and, of course, environmentalists who say, who call this sort of a treadmill. If we add more and more resistance to different pesticides within a single seed, are you just going to lead to more and more spraying of different pesticides? And are we going to continue to use more pesticides? And where does that end?
I got to ask also about
I
got to ask about the fact that farmers are getting dicamba on their crop, who don't use it themselves, of course. Now maybe they'll have to buy this seed from Monsanto, the company that produces this weed killer, maybe to save their crop next year. It kind of seems like forcing a product on people that would prefer not to use it or choose not to use it for some reason. Is there any debate about that, that in ways Monsanto has a loop here? They have a cycle. They have the problem and they have the solution, and they sell both of these products.
Right. I mean, yeah, so some of the farmers I talked to definitely talked about that they didn't buy the seed, this past year, but they kind of feel like their hand is being forced going forward, that if they don't buy this seed, then their soybeans are going to die. So it kind of, some of them feel like they've been put in a very difficult situation. And, it's a really, it's a debate that's gotten quite ugly. There was even one, one murder.
Wow.
Where a farmhand shot a farmer over this dispute, because there was a dispute about this dicamba drift. So, it's gotten that serious. It's divided a lot of farmers.
It's easy to roll your eyes at that, but when this is their livelihood and the situations, you can see why tensions would rise. Not, of course, that we'd advocate them rising that high, but it just goes to show that this debate is not something that is on the surface level. This runs really deep into the agriculture world. Danny, we got to wrap up here, but thank you so much for breaking down that really complicated issue in such a short amount of time.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Plenty more coming up on the Wintrust Business Lunch after this. Twelve 20 here on 720 WGN. John Hanson in for Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Man, Griffin, nothing like saying Monsanto and GMOs to get the text line going. But obviously, it's not a new discussion by any stretch of the imagination. It's something that has raged on for plenty of time now. Got a lot of texts. At one point, they changed the name of one division of the company. Says the 262. The Village Voice did great reporting on Monsanto. 773 wondered, some countries don't allow the sale of GMO crops in their countries. I don't know exactly about that. Has this been addressed? It's a great question. I don't have an answer for you today. And obviously, Monsanto is kind of a buzzword amongst people. And, the one thing I'll say about GMO crops, and there's studies that go both ways on these sorts of things, but you don't get to feed the world of 7 billion people without genetically modifying our crops and feeding the animals that eat the seed. There's just no way to do it. Genetically modified crops saved India from starving in the 60s and 70s. So you can't feed the world without some GMOs, but that doesn't mean that the debate isn't not an important one. Okay, plenty more coming up here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A rail showdown on Goose Island. That sounds like the climax of an old-fashioned Western film. But in fact, it's a real-life battle between real estate developers here in Chicago and the owner of some railroad tracks. Albie Galoon is a senior reporter at Crane Chicago Business. Albie, thanks so much for joining us to talk about this afternoon.
Great to be with you, John.
Okay, so I didn't even know, Albie, that I didn't know that a company could own railroad tracks exclusively, but that's what Iowa Pacific Holdings does. So what tracks do they own? Where are we talking about here in the city?
So Iowa Pacific is a Chicago rail company, and they bought some tracks in and around Goose Island on the north branch of the Chicago River. This is a historically an industrial area, and there's, over the past, decades, there's been plenty of rail traffic in and out of there. It's the site of the former Finkel Steel site, which was cleared a few years ago. And so now they don't really need to ship anything in and out of there. And there are other manufacturers there as well. But what's gotten property owners agitated on Goose Island is that this company now is storing a lot of tanker cars, about 24 tanker cars, right on these rails. And, some of them go right down the street to Goose Island, and the property owners are complaining that they're a nuisance and safety hazard, and, it's only a matter of time before somebody gets in a car accident or some pedestrian gets hit. And so that, that seems like a minor property dispute. Why do we care?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is an area that's poised to go through a rapid, a major transformation. The city earlier this year passed some new plan for the North Branch. It's going to, in 10, 15 years, it's going to be a real mix of office, residential, retail. It's right between Lincoln Park and Bucktown. And so here's a remnant of the area's industrial past, and it's causing some angst among property owners.
So, Albie, I got to ask, just clarifying. So, these tracks where these tankers are stored, these are not tracks that's moving freight back and forth. These are old tracks that are, I don't want to say abandoned. They're still obviously in use, but they're not in use in the way that we think of the Metro lines or the Union Pacific lines. They're really just for storing these tankers.
Correct. I mean, they're not. They're empty. They're empty tanker cars. They're just sitting there. And if you talk to the company that owns them, Iowa Pacific, they say, we have a legitimate business reason for using these tracks. We own these tracks, and right now there is a surplus of tanker cars nationwide, and they say they're running out of space. They have tracks in Bensonville and Elk Grove Village. This company stores like 6,000 rail cars around the country, so it's a pretty big business for them. And but it clashes with what's going on in Goose Island.
Right.
And why this is important is actually there's the owner of the Finkel Steel site has filed an action with the Federal Surface Transportation Board, and they want to get the Surface Transportation Board to basically get Iowa Pacific to abandon these tracks. And it's probably going to be a pretty adversarial process.
Why can't we do it the old-fashioned way where you just meet the price that they want? I mean, this happens a lot in when you develop big things and there's something in the way, there's someone there, there's got to be a price. Pay the price.
Well, that's a very good question. And, I'm guessing that's probably happened with the developer in Iowa Pacific, and they just haven't been able to come to an agreement. Now, another landlord on Goose Island wants Iowa Pacific to move the cars, and they said, please get your cars away from my building. And Iowa Pacific said, well, that's going to cost you $275,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so that conversation went nowhere. So the property owners look at this and they view it as a shakedown. Here's a rail company that owns these tracks that really, in their opinion, shouldn't be there any longer because the neighborhood has changed. And they're going to be shaking down landlords there for money because they own this valuable asset. It's like they're a holdout. When a developer wants to build a big project and has to assemble properties to do it, you know, oftentimes there are one or two landowners who won't sell to them, and they hold out and they're stubborn, and they want a very high price for their land. So it's somewhat analogous to that. But again, Iowa Pacific says we want to run our business here, and we have a legitimate reason for having our cars there.
I like in the article that you that the landlord mentions railroad trolls, which I've never heard of. I've heard of internet trolls and patent trolls, and I imagine that's more like a patent troll that they're alluding to with the railroad that's not easy to say. Railroad trolls. I got to ask, Albie, is there any imminent domain argument to be made in the good of the development of the city, that this is where the city wants to go, to make it a little less industrial, residential, a little bit more office space, that they have a legitimate argument to say, look, this is what we where we want to go, and we're going to pay you, and we're going to kick you out of here?
You know, I'm sure the city attorneys and attorneys for Sterling Bay, the owner of the Finkel site, are looking at all their legal options, and that may be one of them. I don't know. You know, railroad law is kind of arcane, and, you know, I don't know if it would apply in this situation, but it's a very good question. I'm sure that, you know, Sterling Bay and the city are going to look at all their options.
And I'm sure we're going to keep track of it on Crane's Chicago Business. Albie, I'm one of these, I'm fascinated by names and really good names. And Albie Galoon is one of my favorites of all time. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Just rolls off the tongue, Galoon. Okay, we're going to have the news in just a bit and then more Winter's Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Thank you, Bob. 720 WGN, 1234. John Hansen in for Amy Guth on today's Wintrust Business Lunch on a hot Saturday afternoon, as you heard Bob describe. 312-91-7200. When it gets this hot out, I always like to say it's a gorgeous day outside, but do you really want to be outside? So where are you listening today? Are you inside and the air conditioning comfortable? Or are you enjoying outside, getting some last yard work done for the fall, because you never know, or as we start the fall, because you never know how many hot Saturday afternoons you're going to get here. So I'd love to hear from you, 312-981-7200. Shifting gears a bit, dealing with the death of a loved one is, of course, look, a very trying time for loved ones or next of kin. But it can also be very confusing. You know, planning a funeral under the best of circumstances is sad, but under the worst of circumstances, it can get you ripped off. The tech world, once again, is perhaps coming to the rescue, and to chat about that is Adina Solomon, another great name, and a journalist who wrote a fascinating article in the Washington Post about this. Adina, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I consider myself very lucky. I've never had to plan a funeral. I've never had to go through that process. So I certainly have had loved ones die, but other people my parents have taken care of the funeral, of course, for their parents. But I'm sure many of our listeners have gone through this process. It can be just a really confusing process, right? And that's really where some of the trouble lies.
Right. It's a confusing process because thankfully this is something that people don't have to do too much in life. Almost everybody has to do it at some point, but it's not a purchase that we come up to a lot, you know. It's not like buying like kitchenware or cleaning supplies or something. We're not as familiar with the prices as, you know, some other items that we might buy.
Right. And when we watch commercials on TV, you might see one for a funeral home, but there's never prices listed on TV. Whereas, like you said, other products out there, even if we don't buy them all the time, we're familiar with generally how much they cost. So, and it's also a very delicate subject. So I imagine it's not something we like to talk about all that much. We're very uncomfortable, of course, with death, and perhaps for good reason. And does that just contribute to people, you know, signing up for things, buying things before they even know how much they cost?
Yeah, I think that could be a contributing factor, because there is definitely, like I talked in my article, there is definitely kind of a cultural taboo in America when it comes to death. And there's even sometimes a belief that if you, you know, plan a funeral, or if you talk about that stuff, then it's kind of inviting bad luck. So, you know, people don't love to talk about this.
And again, if you don't know what you're supposed to be paying, you know, a $16,000 bill, which you referred to with one family, that might be surprisingly high for them, but maybe they don't know. But that's more than double the median cost of $6,000. But again, if you don't know that going in, how would you ever know that, I guess you could say? And that's, you know, we're in this day and age, we buy so much online. I imagine people go to the internet to try and find out what the prices are, some of those things. And that's really, going to the internet is where the problem exists in the story that you talk about.
Right. So that's why some tech websites have tried to come in and kind of demystify the prices when it comes to funerals, where you can go online and you can see generally what it costs in your area. So that's kind of where it's coming in.
Right, because right now, if you call a funeral home, they have to give you the price if you ask for it. But if you go online, they don't have to do that. Am I reading that correctly?
No, that's correct. There's something called the funeral rule, which is a federal rule. And funeral homes have to give the prices on the phone when you ask and in person on like a price list on paper. But there's no rule, except in California, there's no rule saying that they have to do it online, which is where the problem starts coming in, because most funeral homes do not have it online.
When I was reading just generally, this is going to sound a little morbid, but when you said that there's internet companies coming to the rescue, I almost thought, oh no, is there going to be like Uber hearses or something like that to really save? I know it's so morbid to think, but it's a little simpler than that. It's just providing transparencies and websites going to the extra effort to do that. So, right?
Right. Yeah. It's kind of a funny story to write, or it's a funny story for me to write, at least, because it's something that's so common in every other industry, right? Like you can do that if you're planning vacation, you want to look up car rental prices or hotels, or if you want to look up just buying a car, other big purchases that you might make, you can go online. It's no problem. And it's funny that it's kind of news that it's happening in the funeral industry. That's the funny part to me.
So what are these websites doing? Do they call the funeral homes? Do funeral homes provide them with the information? How do they get this information?
Sure. I mean, of course, the specifics depend on the website, but in general, what you do is you go on, you put in your city or your zip code for basically anywhere in the U.S., depending where you are. And then it'll come up with funeral homes near you and the general price, depending on what you want. I mean, do you want cremation? What kind of casket do you want? What else is there? Embalming, that could add a lot of money. And it'll tell you the general price, but then you kind of have to, depending on the website, you do have to reach out from there and actually plan the funeral offline, which is interesting.
Yeah, it seems, again, this seems so silly, but I'm just shocked that there's not a site where there's a drop-down menu and you choose your options there and you click a button and then you print it out, or you get a QR code on your phone and you bring it to the funeral home and you scan it in. I mean, honestly, I'm shocked that no one has come up with that yet.
No, that sounds like a good idea, but...
Right, wait, why did I just tell that to everyone listening? I should just do this myself.
Yeah, I mean, sounds like you got a good business idea here, but yeah, the way it was explained to me when I was doing the story was the reason that they don't have something like that where you can just book it is because funerals can get, they can get complicated, right? And there's a lot of different questions that come up again, like cremation or not, or what are you going to do there? Where are you going to be buried? Are you going to have a limo? I mean, there's a lot of different, it's a little bit like, it's kind of weird comparison, but it's a little bit like planning a wedding.
Yeah.
A lot of moving parts.
Well, and there's more than one cook. There's more than one planner. It's not like it's one person planning one thing. Often there's many kids involved. The next of kin involves a lot of people. And I imagine you wouldn't want the ability for one of the kids to impart their decisions on to the rest of them. So I understand that. So parting.com offers prices for more than 15,000 funeral homes. That's one of them. You're based out of Atlanta, and they have a site there, too, that does this locally.
Yes. It's called Funeralocity, and they launched in Atlanta, but I know that they're going to expand to other markets by the end of the year. I think it's the top 25 metropolitan statistical areas in the U.S. That's what's going on now. I actually found out about Funeralocity because I saw a bus ad for it, like on the
really?
Side of the bus, which is interesting because you usually see like, you know, movies or a perfume ad or something there.
Well, you know, it's interesting because where I see the most funeral advertisements for homes is usually on billboards. I don't see it too often on television or on the radio. You mostly see it on the billboards. I got to ask, we're a business show, so I'm curious, these companies, these websites aren't doing this necessarily out of the goodness of their heart. How do these websites make money? Do they get a cut of it? Do the funeral homes pay them to advertise for them?
That is a good question. So no, you don't, as a consumer, you don't pay anything. But the model is dependent on the websites. There was one where, let's see, they had another business where they were selling like software directly to funeral homes. I think this is Parting. But they're selling software directly to funeral homes to kind of like an interface on their computer to book things. And let's see, Funeralocity, it takes a cut of, it takes a cut of some of the funeral homes right. that are in like their excellence program.
So probably the same way some real estate, it's the same way some real estate websites work. It's just either they're taking a cut in or they can give you preferred advertising, something like that. It's really a fascinating subject. I've gotten two ideas down. I'm going to cross out Uber hearses, and I'm sure I'm going to get texts about that. And I'm going to use the drop down one, and I'm going to never work here again. I'm going to make a lot of money. Adina Solomon, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. It's really a fascinating discussion.
Having me.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to wrap things up on the Winter's Business Lunch after this with one of my favorite guests of all time. You'll love her if you haven't heard her already. It's Dr. Sandy Goldberg. She has founded a Silver Lining Foundation. They do some fantastic work. We're going to chat about all that coming up next on 720 WGN. Having a good time already with Dr. Sandy Goldberg, one of my favorite guests of all time. You're wonderful, Dr. Sandy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine and wonderful. Comes right back at you, John.
We always love chatting, whether it's on the U or now.Chicago. We've had a chance to chat a few times. But you guys do some incredible work at a Silver Lining Foundation. Your mission to ensure dignified, respectful, and equal access to quality center education and services for all, which sounds like a bunch of words in a row, but really what you do is you save lives.
We save lives and we ease lives. And, you know, that's equally as important these days, John, because how many people don't have access to testing, breast health testing particularly, and how many people feel in today's medical world that they're being treated like a number and they have no one to talk to?
I think most people feel like they're being treated by a number. And especially as the healthcare debate rages on, I think more and more we feel like just a number. And for many of us, that number is going up in terms of premiums. But that's a whole nother discussion.
Oh, yes, indeed.
For another
yes,
day.
Indeed.
So when you talk about what you guys do, who do you help?
We help pretty much anybody that needs access to breast health testing, or we help anyone who needs resource information, education, and outreach services. We do all kinds of things at a Silver Lining Foundation, but what we do focus around is breast health testing. That really is, frankly, as a survivor of breast cancer, you know, my baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that's obviously very personal to you. I love the story that you've told me before about your mother and the name A Silver Lining Foundation. Could you share that with our listeners?
Sure, sure. Everything we do actually is based on the philosophy of my late mother. In my generation, as you know, Johnny, the parents would sit at the kitchen table, the father would write the checks, and the mother would have to explain what the bills were for. So my 6'2" father would say to my 4'8" mother, who are these people and why am I paying for their rent? Mm-hmm. Or it's a lot of food for four people. And my mother would pick herself up and she would say, we are all family and we have to help each other through the tough times. So that is our philosophy. That's the foundation of everything that we do. And in terms of the name, and you know, it's amazing how smart your parents get the older you get, you know.
My parents are listening right now. I'm sure they'll be happy to hear that.
Yes, indeed. And I am telling you, and they will tell you again when we're off the show. But I remember I'd go to my mother and I would be complaining about the world, you know, the boy, the dress, the this, the that. And my mother would say to me, you know, there's always a silver lining. And when my husband and I started a Silver Lining Foundation 15 years ago, almost to the day, those words from my mother came back. And that is, again, why we decided to name it and follow and actually have this foundation be her legacy in many ways.
It's fascinating how it got started. It got started at the kitchen table, right?
It did. It did. You know, I think we learn a lot of things when we go through a circumstance in which we didn't expect to go through. I mean, who expects to be diagnosed with breast cancer? Who expects to have to deal with all of those challenges? And here I was diagnosed, but I was very, very fortunate, very fortunate. Great insurance, great support. You know, my family at NBC in Chicago circled the wagons just phenomenally well. And so I had what I needed. And I ended up creating a little cable show with the American Cancer Society because I said to them, what do you people do, actually? And
you're a TV personality.
I am fortunate enough that media embraces what we do and understands that I have a big mouth that goes along with this platinum hair that's on my head now. But from that little cable show, A Silver Lining was born because that's when I discovered there was me And there was everybody else in the world. And we're going back like 16 years ago, John.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about fast forwarding today, about how people, you know, people don't feel worthy anymore. They really don't feel worthy to access testing. They don't feel worthy to access health. You know, I mean, many times you go in, the first thing you're asked for is your insurance card. And I'm not saying that health professionals and institutions have to make ends meet and deal with the bottom line. Mm-hmm. But I think in general in our world today, see, you got me on my soapbox,
yeah.
that there is a sort of almost a lack of humanity,
yeah. You
know.
Through the cable show, you heard from people that just didn't know what to do, right? And that's you were becoming, in a way, their advisor in some of these things.
It was, you know, and that's a very good point that you bring up, is that I learned that our show was, for many people, their primary care physician. And our show outpaced, or the calls outpaced the time of the show. And so I would call everybody back. And I realized, and I'm making suggestions from my world, you know, this uber-protected, loved world in which, although I certainly hated the treatment, I mm-hmm. never had to worry about paying for it.
Right.
And I realized that people felt that they weren't worthy because they had no money and they had no insurance, and that made me sick. You know, I was brought up that everybody puts on their shoes the same way.
Right.
And to be able to take that and translate that in and watch it grow into now five programs, the yeah. heart of which is our breast health testing program. We call it Buy a Mom a Mammogram, but it encompasses so much more. We actually fund the entire spectrum of breast health testing, screenings, all the way up the food chain to and including biopsies to individuals who are uninsured, underinsured, and are undocumented. We turn no one away.
I imagine that it's speed. It's getting these things done quickly. And to me, it's insane. I mean, we could have debates about healthcare, and I'm sure other people have a lot of opinions on it. But in terms of preventative health, it is insane to me that anyone has to pay a dollar for a test to at least answer where they go next, what happens next. But you mentioned uninsured, but many people are underinsured. These tests are not covered.
No, the tests aren't covered. And I can tell you story after story after story. And it's amazing because the evolution of a silver lining really has come in response to phone calls or circumstances which we have become aware of. I mean, we funded originally uninsured. And then I got a call from a woman that said, you know, my insurance will cover this, but I can't go on to the next. Why? Because I have a $6,500 deductible and I make $12 an hour. And we heard that over and over and over again about the deductibles, about the copays. So we had to add, you know, in all good conscience. Then we added a program and testing for breast cancer survivors. Again, from a phone call from a woman who said, you know, my insurance will cover a mammogram. I am a survivor. But Dr. Sandy, I don't have a breast. So again, we leap right into that again.
How does it work for people that want to find out? And it's as simple as a phone call, right, to start?
It is. All you have to do, to all of your listeners out there, and thank you, Jenny, so much for allowing me to do this, is to call 312-345-1322.
In this business, we say it again. You say the phone number twice, of course, Sandy.
And I most certainly shall. Can I call you, Johnny?
You've been doing it on the whole interview.
I know.
Are we that close now that you're the only one that ever has called me Johnny? I kind of like it. That's our new thing.
It absolutely is. Mm-hmm. Sandy and Johnny. We should have a song that way. Well, all right. The second number, because Johnny will tell me I have to do it again anyway, is 312-345-1322.
And that's for anyone that thinks that they might need some help, right?
It's for anyone who is uninsured, underinsured, concerned, needs to talk to somebody about their breast health. We now fund 15 partner hospitals, Johnny. And we fund them in the greater Chicagoland area, Rockford, Elgin, Evanston, Des Plaines. And all of our partner hospitals are remarkable in that they're warm, loving, accepting, and recognize the fact that every human being, as you say, is supposed to be treated with dignity and respect.
Dr. Sandy's got to turn off her cell phone. Is that already the phone? Is someone calling in right now?
It could It could very well be. And I thought I turned it off. And my apologies.
Okay.
For that.
You can do whatever you want. That's a fancy case there you got there, Dr. Sandy. Well, so you have a fancy case. You look as beautiful as can be. These gorgeous earrings. But obviously, you're not paying for all this out of your pocket. That'd be incredible. How do you guys raise the money to pay for all this?
Well, first of all, we're fortunate again to have media and support, such as your show today. We ask people to donate. We have corporate support. We write grants and more grants and more grants. Our big gala, our major fundraising event, although we have multiple events throughout the course of the year, is coming up on October the 7th. And you, I understand, have another event that night.
I do. I'll be out of town for that day, unfortunately. And I also missed the event a couple weeks ago, so I'm just the worst. But the October 7th event, tickets are still available for
tickets
people to go?
Tickets are still available. Please go on our website, asilverliningfoundation.org, and you can purchase tickets there. And the event is underwritten. Every dime that is raised will go to our programs, in particular, our breast health testing program.
It's turning into your cable show. We're getting some texts and some questions. I hope you don't mind if I ask you one, because you might be able to help someone out.
Fire away.
The 847 says, I've not had a mammogram, and one reason is that I anticipate the technician will not be accustomed to using the equipment. She says she has, and this is her volunteering, this is she has a small breast, and she wants to know, can you reassure me about women with smaller breast sizes being able to have a mammogram?
Absolutely. The size of the breast doesn't matter, and I'll tell you why when you talk about small breasts. Men need mammograms also in certain situations. So I would concern myself not at all with the size of your breast. I would concern myself with having a mammogram, because breast size and diagnosis of breast cancer have nothing to do one with each other. So make sure you take your small breast over and get a mammogram.
Johnny and Sandy going to come to WGN at some point. We could do a whole hour, I imagine. We're going to get a lot of phone calls, a lot of questions about that, and I'll be able to forward them over to you, Dr. Sandy. Really appreciate it. And one more time, that phone number, please.
312-345-1322.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And right back at you, my dear.
We'll wrap things up on the Wintrust Business Lunch after this on 720 WGN.